Good morning, and welcome to the February 17th President's Day edition of Mountain Money. I'm your co-host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger.
And welcome to those who are in town. Looks like a great day for skiing on this holiday Monday. But if you're not skiing and you want to sit for the next hour, we've got some interesting stuff for you. We're going to start our morning by speaking with Mark Satterfield. He's the author of The Gilded Revival, America's Return to an Age of Wealth and Glamour.
And then we'll be joined by John Kenworthy of Flanagan's on Main about how Flanagan has managed to thrive on Main Street for so long. And we'll end the hour with Gary Wolfarth of Back 40 Ranch House Grill in Heber.
All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. The term Gilded Age evokes images of late 19th century robber barons building mansions on Fifth Avenue in New York City. But in some sense, the emphasis in the current era on wealth and glamour marks a return to some of the characteristics of the original Gilded Age. Author Mark Satterfield looks at both the similarities and differences between the two in his new book, The Gilded Revival, America's Return to the Age of Wealth and Glamour. Good morning, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
So, Mark, let's start with the late 19th century. How do you define the key elements of the original Gilded Age?
Well, the Gilded Age, of course, came about as a result of a lot of, you know, technological increases in America. You saw, you know, mass production of, you know, beginning of automobiles. You saw the steel industry. You saw the railroads. And it was really for the first time we saw this enormous concentration of wealth among a relatively few people. And of course, these wealthy people, not terribly surprising, wanted to show off their wealth. And so this evoked really the first era of what we might call conspicuous consumption and display, with the mansions and the jewelry and the garments and all of that. And it was really the first time that excess was put on display, although certainly not to the extent that it is today.
Now, is it just the names that we know, like Rockefeller, that were displaying this wealth, or were there some other kind of unknowns?
It was pretty much the people that you would know. There was a lady named Astor, who was really the lady who set the social stage in New York City. She built a house where legend had it. It held 400 people, and she built it for that size because she felt that those were that was the number of people that mattered in society. And so it was, you know, very much of, you know, an elitist culture. It was one where, you know, it was us and them. I mean, looking back on it, remnants of it, of course, still exist, but, you know, it's almost humorous in terms of, you know, kind of, you know, the nose up in the air aspects of it. But yeah, you know, the names you would know, the Mellons, the Morgans, the Rockefellers, that gang.
So how did they create this sort of society of their own? And more importantly, how are they perceived by the great unwashed general public?
Well, they created it through just, you know, a phenomenal amount of wealth. You got to remember, this was the time before for income tax. So, the amount of money that people had was extremely high. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question?
It was about how was it perceived by the general public. I mean, one of the things you mentioned before, it's not surprisingly they wanted to flaunt their wealth. It actually is a little surprising in the sense that this was the first time something like that had happened. And they did it and were watched by the general public. How did the general public get a window into the lives of the Rockefellers and the Astors?
Well, interestingly, and that's one of the main differences between now and then, is they didn't have that much of a sense for it, because it was very, very isolated. It was restricted to the Upper East Side of New York. It was restricted to Newport. People read about it. There was a certain amount of envy. People would see these mansions on Park Avenue, and there was a certain amount of, you know, of envy, but it was very much, you have to remember that back then, You know, we didn't have social media. News was, you know, very limited in terms of people's awareness of what was going on. So you didn't have as big of a backlash as one might expect, at least in the beginning. And of course, when the recession hit, you know, the Great Depression, then of course, people started looking at specifically the bankers, the Morgans of the world, and then a lot of cultural, a lot of cultural uprising started to occur. But in the beginning, they functioned really pretty much under the radar for really a couple of decades.
Right. So no social media, but we did have the Society column at the time. What was the influence of the Society column?
It was very, very high, but within that group of very wealthy people. You know, if you were a part of that group, you were clawing and fighting to, you know, get accepted and to, you know, get at the right tables at the right places. You know, that's to a certain extent still goes on today. Again, it was very much a insular type of communication. You didn't have, you know, the social media. You didn't have the widespread dissemination of the pictures of the wealthy. So within that small group, it was extremely high.
So how did the perception of wealth as status begin to shift in the 1980s? And again, one of the things you talked about in the book is how is that symbolized by the film Wall Street and the rise of the yuppie?
Well, of course, you have to remember that, you know, the 1970s were kind of a disaster on so many different levels. You had, you know, record high inflation. You had, a culture where wealth was looked down on, but that really changed in the 80s, and there were two real main factors. One being Wall Street became cool. Wall Street largely became cool because of the movie Wall Street, which, you know, was very ironic because Gordon Gekko was created by Oliver Stone to be this, you know, terrible villain and someone that no one would want to emulate. And instead, a generation of young men decided that, hey, this is great. Greed is good. I want some of that. So you saw this influx of the best and brightest going into Wall Street. And then this corresponded, of course, with the rise in technology. And you saw the technological boom, and along with that, created a very large wealthy class that did not come from the historic wealth of previous generations. It wasn't inherited. It was people literally working out of the garage and coming up with a technology company, which they then brought public and created an enormous amount of wealth. So we start to see in the 80s, the wealth starting to be broader and among more people and more different people. And that was one of the biggest changes that took place when you compare it to what happened historically in the Gilded Age of the 1800s.
Right. So how did the tech boom change the way the image of wealth was defined?
Became more aspiration. You now could become very, very wealthy by creating a new tech solution. You didn't have to. Being wealthy was not restricted to where you went to school. It was not restricted to your family. It was not restricted to inheritance. You could actually now start a company and build it up and make just a pile of dough. And that was really the most significant change.
And as we go along those lines, how do social media moguls like a Kylie Jenner or Mark Zuckerberg sort of exemplify the change in the way that wealth is understood?
Well, again, it goes with Zuckerberg. It's that anybody can do it. If you have a good idea and you're absolutely relentless and tenacious, you can create this level of wealth. When you get into the Kardashians, there's a very interesting story because they became wealthy by communicating a look at me approach to the masses, whereas historically the wealthy kept it very much unto themselves. And with the social media with the increase in social media and the influencers, it now became much more of a look at me approach, and that wealth is wonderful. I'm having this wonderful lifestyle. This is absolutely tremendous. You should aspire to this, and that was that was a huge change from what historically had taken place.
Yeah, you highlight a number of individuals in the book who have sort of made, for lack of a better term, something out of nothing. In contrast to a Cornelius Vanderbilt, who created real things and had massive material changes in the world, you highlight people who basically make a career and monetize just being themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the positive impact that many of these people today have had on society, I mean, it's negligible. You go back to the Gilded Age and you look at the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers and the Mellons, and you look at the industries they created and then the technology they created. Today, yes, you have some of this. You have Elon Musk with automotive and space. You have Zuckerberg, of course, with Facebook and technology. And so there's a lot of very good, positive changes that have come about by very wealthy people. But alongside them have been a lot of people who, their contribution to society is negligible, but they're very well known. They are very wealthy, but they are very wealthy because they're very well known, which is, something that if you go back 100 years, no one would ever guess that could possibly take place.
Can you give us a few examples of those people, please?
Well, I mean, it started, of course, with Paris Hilton back in the 90s. And so, one argument for that is, well, you start off by making a sex tape, and then then it goes from there. But Paris Hilton was probably the first that became famous for being famous, and then. Her friend, Kim Kardashian, picked up on it, also initially with a sex tape, but very, very clever. What they did was not only used their TV show to stay in the public eye, but they diversified, and they actually came up with companies in fashion, companies in makeup, and so they diversified from just the look at me because you're looking at me type of stuff to actually creating businesses, and then very, very astutely managed the brand, and it really is a brand, and stayed connected with their audience, did a marvelous job. They were probably, and still today, are probably one of the best users of social media in terms of staying connected, keeping people engaged, and they really paved the way. But since then, it's been countless numbers of others.
One of the things you talk about in the book that I thought was interesting was how the definition of glamour has moved from an exclusive emphasis on material goods to an emphasis on experiences. Can you explain that?
Right. That is a big shift. Whereas today, historically, it was the houses that you lived in, the cars that you drove, that type of thing. But today, especially when you look at the affluent who are younger, what they're really interested in is the experiences. And the experiences, of course, includes some things like travel, which has been historic, but also experiences in terms of just day to day kinds of things. the experiences of not only does what does my house look like, but what is the experience like once I'm in it? And spending the money to curate a environment inside a house unique to them. So yes, they've definitely gone much more towards the experience part. Also, of course, along with that has been the uptick in health and wellness, and spending the money to improve longevity, improve quality of life. The whole biohacking piece, has come about as a direct result of that shifting focus.
And one of the things that really struck me is I don't think anyone in the high society and the Titanic was writing daily missives about how the trip was going. In contrast, this notion of showing what fun I'm having on travel is ubiquitous in terms of people showing off what they're doing.
Oh, absolutely. And the big part of it is it's just so easy.
Yeah.
You may have kept a diary, you may have, written some postcards, you may have sent out some letters. Today, you just post. You take a picture and you post it on your Instagram, on your Facebook. You shoot your little video, which you put up on YouTube. It is just so easy. Anyone can do it. So as a result, everyone does. And that is just created, an enormous amount of noise. So then what do we gravitate to? What out there is it that catches our eye? And not surprisingly, historically, people have wanted to live certain lifestyles. They're fascinated with, boats and jets and yachts and, things that these people have. So you can have people who really, if you drill down on their net worth, it's negligible, but they're putting up an image of enormous affluence and it's very much a look at me. Now, what they're trying to do, and most of them aren't being successful, is they're trying to be the Kardashians or the Paris Hiltons. And they're trying to take that and get it to a point where people say, oh, this is so great, I'm going to follow him or her en masse, and then they can hopefully get some advertising revenue. But that rarely actually happens.
And those are the influencers, right? They start something, they go on to a trip, they video it, and then they post it, and they're influencers. And then eventually some resorts will pay them to show up and shoot some videos, I assume.
Yeah, if you can get it to scale. That therein lies the big challenge, because you've gotten to a point where there's so many influencers out there that they are they're all fighting for the same eyeball. So it's the high end influencers are doing fine. Now, of course, what you see it becoming increasingly more niche. So you'll see influencers in Pilates. Well, there's lots of influencers in Pilates. So then you'll have influencers in women who are premenopausal in Pilates, and they'll build up a very, very niched audience, which of course a very specific advertiser will be interested in. So it's getting increasingly fragmented as time goes on.
So what was unique about Kylie Jenner and how did she pull it off?
Well, first of all, smart lady, without a doubt. She, her mom is a very smart lady. She, to a certain extent, you can say, well, she rode the coattails of her big sister. But having said that, she placed some bets in terms of fashion and makeup and did extremely well. She's good looking, which is always important in this visually oriented world that we live in. She did a very good job, when you really analyze it, of giving out enough information so that her fans felt connected with her without overdoing it, and so they got tired of her. And that's a very fine line. And very few people can master that, but she did a great job of it and continues to this day.
Within the book, there's a chapter where you're talking about personal finance as a lifestyle and financial influencers as wealth icons. That's something different, too. I mean, historically, you went to a broker or a financial advisor, and now there's all this information on the web where people are trying to portray themselves as financial advisors and building followings. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine line. You can't, of course, position yourself as a financial advisor without, you know, the appropriate type of license mm-hmm. and things. But this is partially the fault of the financial advising community, which historically said, you know, 80% of your investments in bonds and 20% in stocks, or, you know, 60-40, whatever. But what today's affluent society realizes is that there's lots and lots of different ways to invest, and crypto being, you know, huge. And so the traditional financial community thought, first of all, crypto was a fad, and then second of all, just never embraced it for a variety of reasons. But that left the door open for a whole slew of financial advisors to come in and talk about crypto and the advantages and disadvantages. That left the door open for a whole bunch of people to talk about all different investment alternatives, such as, you know, real estate, being the big one. But again, you know, historically, this is, you know, this has gone on for, you know, for a long time. There have always been people that have been touting, you know, invest in gold, invest in, you know, Florida real estate, even, you know, despite the land being, you know, somewhat underwater. you know, it's not necessarily something new. It's just a lot more prominent. Again, big bullhorns, big social media. And of course, again, this goes to you know, the marketing part, and this is where, of course, you know, I spend my life, which is, how do you get eyeballs? How do you get people to, you know, pay attention? And how do you transition from social media to then your platform where you sell them some sort of, you know, information product or course or whatever? But yeah, you know, when you think about what are people interested in, you know, they're interested in, you know, greed is huge, has been, will always be. So if there's somebody out there who can give us some, you know, interesting ideas, perspective, advice on something we haven't heard or thought about that is going to make us money, there's always going to be people who are going to at least listen to the pitch. If nothing else, I mean, you know, the Nigerian prince who has, you know, died and left you, you know, $400 billion, if only you'll, you know, give him your PIN number. You know, it's been going on for Lord knows how long.
So, Mark, before we go, there are cultural legacies of the original Gilded Age that remain with us today. The libraries that were established by Andrew Carnegie and the other kinds of things that some of these titans did from a philanthropic perspective. How do you think the cultural legacy of this new Gilded Age is going to be?
That's a great question. And I think it's still to be written. I think certainly this new Gilded Age has an appreciation for education, and that is, I think, a little bit different than what happened in the 1800s. So you do see a more of an focus on education in terms of both supporting educational institutions and supporting students through scholarships. We've definitely seen an uptick in that. But you know, what's going to be the lasting legacy? That's going to be, you know, that's going to be hard to tell. Certainly, if, you know, Musk can do what he wants to do with space travel, you know, we may eventually get those flying cars that the Jetsons promised. But you know, that as I say, is a little ways off in the future.
Okay, we've been speaking with Mark Satterfield about his new book, The Gilded Revival: America's Return to an Age of Wealth and Glamour. Mark, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back after this.
I often hear from visitors to our town about restaurants that they went to while visiting Park City. Flanagan's is one of those places that is mentioned. We are fortunate to be joined in studio by Flanagan's owner, John Kenworthy. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning, Park City. Happy President's
Day.
Awesome. So let's start off. When did Flanagan's open?
November 08.
November 08. So that's, someone do the math.
17 years ago, Kevin.
Outstanding. Outstanding. And you were one of the original owners at that time.
Correct.
Okay. So you came into a building. What was in that building before, JK?
The Hungry Moose. That's Remember right. Chuck?
Yep.
Chuck Saccio.
And did you have to do a major renovation?
Oh, yeah. Got it.
Okay. And so Flanagan's, where does the name come from?
Name comes from, it's a tribute to my grandfather and the Catholic priest who saved Grandpa's life. Took him around the country raising money for his vision of taking care of wayward, abandoned boys. It's amazing he just didn't stop here in Park City and set up shop. But they actually traveled from Omaha, Nebraska on the Union Pacific. And Grandpa and Father got off the train in 1922 and walked up the street and gave out flyers. And Grandpa did a little oration directly across the street at what was then the Federal Bandstand. Federal Bandstand was an open-air patio that all the city officials would sit in during parades and during different things. So they had a little stage, and they took advantage of it. And they, you know, got the miners and the soil doves to contribute to this vision, which today is the largest orphanage, the 90th 501c3 in America. And I know we specialize in 501c3s. So how about this? A little 10-year-old boy and an Irish immigrant priest created the 90th largest in America.
So this is the famous Boys Town that was sort of immortalized in that great Spencer Tracy, Mickey Rooney movie.
That's right. You get free dessert. You got it right. Spencer Tracy, Mickey Rooney made the movie Boys Town 1938. It won two Oscars. Spencer Tracy won an Oscar for portraying Father Flanagan. So that became the impetus for Grandpa to move to Hollywood under Father Flanagan's direction. My grandfather was a man, and my father was born. My aunt was born. And his direction was to look after those strange people in Hollywood and make sure they don't screw up our story, Charlie.
Now, I think that story is posted on the wall in Flanagan's, because I know that
story.
Yeah,
there's some of it that's in the family room. I never told anyone the story until our five-year anniversary when I put that room together. I wanted to make sure we were going to make it.
So tell us a little bit about, for those who haven't had the opportunity to visit Flanagan's, give us a sense of, you know, what kind of bar is it? What kind of restaurant is it?
So the reason we're in business, a mom and pop, is a one in a thousand that has one restaurant to make it in this country. And the reason we're in business is because of our traditional Irish fare. And we really are a pub. We're a traditional Irish pub. We're not, you know, just a bar that calls itself an Irish pub. So our traditional fare, of course, includes the Irish beef stew. It includes the boxties, the shepherd's pie. And our number one seller for 17 years. Come on, Roger. Fish and chips.
Oh, yeah.
I got the corned beef and cabbage too, but the fish and chips and the perfect pint, 20 ounces.
I thought you were going to go for it. Is there a curry dish? There's some dish that sort of leaps off the menu as being different.
Yeah, we do have some different dishes and traditional bar food, but it's the reason we're in business is that section that says Irish fare.
And what's a boxty?
A boxty is a potato pancake wrapped in your choice. You could put corned beef. You could do a whiskey chicken. So it's like a crepe for the French or a burrito for the Hispanic culture. And for the Irish, it's a potato pancake that is wrapped into, you know, an ingredient of your choice.
That would be fantastic. So you could do it with chicken and then take that curry sauce that you put on the French fries and add some of that?
Well, we have our special cream sauce. It's a whiskey chicken cream sauce that we use for that. So we don't put the curry.
And the menu's been pretty stable. I mean, you don't do seasonal variations to any great extent, do you?
No, we don't. What we add is specials. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when Avani gets creative or the guys in the kitchen get creative, they'll do a special. But for the most part, the staples have been there all 17 years.
So you have a traditional Irish, an Irish pub. Does it sort of morph in the evening from a restaurant into more of a bar? Is that Is that what happens?
Yeah, we're very fortunate that we have a downstairs, which is an adult-only license. It's a club license. We do serve the full menu down there, but for the most part, it's shots of tequila, Jameson, and our perfect pints of Guinness. And we're really proud. For 17 years in a row, we're the number one seller of Guinness in the state of Utah.
Outstanding.
My wife and I were hosted back in Dublin, and we were with a lot of different owners from different states. Oh, I own 17. How many do you own? One. What state are you in? Take a guess.
So what's the secret? As I think about Main Street, and you know, before we got started, we were talking about some of the older, you know, places that have come and go along Main Street, and you know, to try to name all the restaurants that have come and gone within six spots of where Flanagan's is today, would you could probably do it, but I know I couldn't. How have you survived? Why are you still here?
So we have had a great one, even just in the building. In the building, we've had the Cozy, we've had Hungry Moose, you've had that, what was that Asian place, Roger? I forget. But these
was
were
that
all
the first Szechuan? Was that
Szechuan?
Was,
there
was,
you go.
It was
you got
Szechuan
it.
Before
you
I moved
got
out of
it. It was
yeah.
Szechuan. So we've had, just in the building, I'm certain we can name, and Car 19, who's to forget.
Ooh.
So we've had all these within the building. So the building's, you know, kind of special in terms of food and beverage over the years. Why have we survived? I would say, without a doubt, it's because of my staff and the way the community embraces them. You know, we are the pub, we are the cheersy place, and I love it when you know, the locals come in and just acknowledge the servers who've been with me for, you know, 10, 12 years of this 17-year run. And that's really been it. And it is seasonal, so a lot of them go away, and, you know, they're over in Hilton Head or they're in Michigan. During the shoulder seasons in the summer, and then they come back for the winter, and it's almost like a family reunion. I'm just so proud of my staff, and you know, it's a very diverse staff from all over that come to really enjoy each other and work the high season, which of course we're in right now.
Wonderful. Now, who besides yourself being there, who's been there the longest of your staff?
Mario, Super Mario, my brother. He's been with me 17 years.
The whole time.
Oh, he's the best.
And what's he do over there?
He's a line cook.
So, John, there's a lot of buzz around town now about the potential future of Main Street. As someone who's been there and been successful for a long time, what are your thoughts about where things ought to go? What do you think of the new Main Street plans that are floating around?
Oh, you're going to get me in trouble. I just had an op-ed responding to Tom Clyde, and I think we're off base with a lot of it. This is historic Main Street. I was chair of the preservation board, partly just it's the first board I got into here, and it's not a board that's overwhelmed with applications. I can assure you. But I wanted to do that in honor of my grandfather, who was here and who absolutely loved Park City in the 20s. Historic preservation is our economic driver. To send out an economic guy, you know, and to turn in a spreadsheet and say, hey, we're adding 300,000 square feet, and here's the price per square feet on the first floor and the second floor and the third floor, is just... It's ass backwards. It is. This is historic preservation driven. You have an opportunity to look at the MARSAC right next to me and expand it so that you don't have a administration building in, you know, in a retail entertainment district. It'd be like putting it on Malibu Beach. You wouldn't put City Hall on, you know, on the beach in Malibu. So we've got a great opportunity here. And, it all starts and ends with the transit. I think we all know what's happening here. 8 years ago, we had our first Carmageddon. Both the Little Cottonwood, Big Cottonwood closed down. 2 feet of snow. And then we had, da-da, the evil Empire Pass. All you can eat snow for $500 a year. And boy, oh boy, we saw what was coming, and it's here. We have 1 million people, you know, out there in the Wasatch Front, all of them buying the, you know, the pass. And we never know how many people are going to show up. You got 18% of the mountain open and 40,000 people on 18% of the mountain. So we've all got to come together as a community, be real, face what's happened, December 26th this year. Ooh, mm-hmm. Ooh, 6-inch snow. 6-inch storm, I should say. I think, you know, we've been in that business for 60 years. We should be able to handle a 6-inch storm, but we didn't. We collapsed. It's not good.
So there are a number of, I don't want to say conflicting, but I would say different visions, big picture, as to, you know, what should be done on the transit side. In the little time we've got left, if you could be the Jolly Green Giant and reach down and move the pieces around, what would you do for transit?
First and foremost, I love gondolas. But I don't like gondolas that don't work. And I've been through that. I was the transportation liaison, and, you know, I knew Steve Isovitz very well, who studied gondolas and gondolas throughout towns, not just in Deer Valley while he was vice president of real estate. So I had the very fortunate to look at these string maps, at the string map when I would go into his office and see what works. What works is the one I'm looking across the town at right now, and that's the town left. These other ones really don't work. You know, we know for a fact Deer Valley Drive doesn't work. We know that in the report from Snow Engineering, one of the best firms in the entire world, and they're right here in Snow Park, so it's easy to give them a call. And what they did is they also studied Rossi Hill. So nobody knows the alignment that they used at Rossi Hill when they used it. And they didn't look at one. I mean, when they chose Deer Valley Drive, it was because it was the best option. And it does not work. And our city has come to terms with that, and it was difficult. So, you know, we really just, the institutional knowledge people really have to be better at so we can move the conversation forward. Every 2 years, we get new city council people. You get a new mayor occasionally, and they just don't have the institutional knowledge, and it's not, there's not a class that's being taught up there at the Marsak building. So I really think we need to expand the historic preservation, fix the transit. I really see an opportunity with the town left. It's a 23-minute death march. I could hike up faster. And it needs to go to the top of the mountain, opening up maybe even if it's a half mile away from Bonanza Flat, year-round use it. Also, it will give access to both mountains if they cooperate, like so many resorts around the world have cooperated, including our neighbors at Alta and Snowbird. So we need some, you know, really just people to cooperate, and the solutions are still there. The good news is the canvas is still here. That piece of marble that Michelangelo went and picked up, that's still here. It's still here. We have the places, the place marks, but we have to get really smart people to connect the dots moving forward.
And so one of the problems with making the town lift shared is probably economic.
Of course, there's an economic component to all of it. There's no doubt. Now, Park City's rich. I mean, you can't do all these consultants after consultant after consultant without having money, mm-hmm. you know? And by the way, let's do a new one. This one, by the way, this gondola study is less than 5 years old. So getting them on board and then defining a new one forward for the people that don't know and getting them on board with what works, simply what works. I want to also put in a plug for Gordo. I think Gordo, we've just cleaned it up. I am 100% behind it. The Deer Valley money I'd love to see used over there along with the city money and put that to work. Start practicing now. Don't build the whole thing out. Get that asphalt over there and go now. Has anybody not been in town these last 4 days?
So you do start with a parking ride, essentially.
Exactly.
That's where you start.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that makes it so much easier to get people in and out.
Okay. We've been talking to John Kenworthy of Flanagan's, who put out a lot of ideas that I'm sitting here digesting in my own mind and have more questions than answers. But, John, thanks for spending time with us. I think it's been a stimulating conversation.
Really, really appreciate you guys having me, and get up there and make some turns, guys.
All right. We'll be right back after this.
Okay, for years, the building that now houses Back 40 Ranch House Grill in Heber has been a landmark. Here to tell us about Back 40 is owner Gary Wolfarth. Gary, thank you for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
And this audio works. I am so happy. and so you are a longtime Park City resident and business person. Is that correct?
Yes, I've been in Park City since 1984.
Wow. Now, can you share a bit of the history of Back 40?
Back 40 was, as many people who have been here a long time, was known as the Other End, which is an old cowboy biker bar, as it would be best described. It existed as a bar going back to the 50s. It was an old ranch house that was moved up near the road. And it had always been a bar prior to me taking it over. It sat vacant for, 6 months before I put the bid on it. And SBA loan, blah, blah, blah. After all that was accepted, we closed May 4th. And 7 months later, we opened it as the Back 40.
And what year was that, Gary?
That was December. I'm sorry. We closed May 4th of 2015.
Yeah,
we opened December 5th.
I remember it as you drive by there, and there would be a lot of motorcycles in front of that bar.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, at one point, it was a really cool spot. It was a hard location, as I found out after I got it. The well water was contaminated with E. coli. There was just tons of issues, zoning, the building. So it was a lot to undertake, probably why nobody else wanted to do it.
So yeah, talk a little bit about that, what you had to do. You mentioned the well. Did you have to do a substantial renovation inside the building as well?
We gutted the whole thing. We took it down to the shell. It had never really been completely remodeled. And it was funny, we were ripping out the old kitchen floor and there was like 4 inches of flooring that was just stacked on top of the old. It looked like a tree ring when we cut it, because it was just, nobody had taken anything out. They just added stuff in. So it required to come down to just the shell.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been easier to tear it down, but zoning wouldn't allow me to do so.
This is a pretty bold and ambitious project you took on. Did you have a background in the food business, or was this your first real venture?
Oh, no, it's all I've done, actually. Since I've been in Park City, I've been in restaurants. And then back in the day, when the town would close down a lot of the restaurants, during the spring, summer, fall, whatever, we all wore our bags and were carpenters. So I developed an extensive building background as well as being in restaurants. So I'd been in restaurants my whole life as my working career since I was 17 years old, moved to Park City, got a bartending job, worked construction. So this was kind of the perfect storm for everything to come together. I'd always wanted to do one, but I always wanted to own the property. I saw how leases can get you in trouble. The more successful you are, the more you pay to the owner of the property. So I was adamant on owning, and Heber was a place that I could actually afford to make that happen.
Yeah, and you have enough parking over there now.
We always have, actually. It's been kind of funny. That's one thing the county had spoken to me about in any kind of expansion that I wanted to do, like the back patio or the yurt. But by code, I do have enough, and I mapped it out and showed them several times. So, and I can't help it if 4 people come to dinner and they all drive their own car.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, let's get on with the restaurant. What are the specialties of the house?
All of our, if you're going by numbers, it'd probably be the most we sell would be our burger. But we also, we have a great salmon dish, which is served with the local marmalade, pepper lane jams. Our burger, I buy the whole cows out back from the rancher, and we've been doing that since day one. So that's an organic product, and we know what they're being finished with, the feed, the grain. Anything that has beef in it, would be our tops, just because of our local meat is a big draw.
And can you flesh that out a little bit? I mean, are you literally talking about buying cows that are grazing behind the restaurant?
Oh yeah. It was, we were into it a month and I was looking at the old well that was there. This rancher pulled up and I told him what I was doing. And he's like, I can help you out, bud. And since then we've been, we don't have a standing order, but it's quite difficult to do in the sense that you can't just pick up the phone and order another cow. So based off history and numbers and, projecting is a big part of the industry. I talked to him at the first of the month. We know how many cows we're going to get. He takes them weighs them, takes them to slaughter, and to do anything for resale, you have to have a brand inspection, which is quite difficult. You have to have a brand inspector at the site when it happens. So all of this is timing that we coordinate, and you know, we've just gotten that perfected to how much we're gonna need for the month. And then I have tons of freezer space. So, you know, it's not like buying 2 cases of hamburger a day and then going through it. We get 150, you know, in 2 weeks and go through it and then refill them. And, you know, so it's a little more logistically difficult, but I think it makes for a better product. And, you know, people think hamburger comes from the grocery store and it doesn't.
It comes from right out there when you sit by one of the windows. You look
exactly,
out.
Yeah.
So you, other than the burger, you have other beef specialties. Is the stroganoff regularly on the menu, or is that a special?
That was a special, and then we decided to put that on. And, you know, our menu is quite diverse, and the one thing that we do, if you look at the menu, you can see it's crossover, right? So we have a ribeye, which is the same cut as the prime rib stroganoff. So, and we also do a ribeye sandwich. We also do prime rib special on Saturday. So, you know, that ribeye is touched 5 times on the menu. Mm-hmm. And same thing, like with the hamburger, you know, chili cheese fries, hamburger, spaghetti and meatballs. All these things we use our proteins quite a bit to allow us to do a large menu. It's just how we put them together.
And I know you also have an interesting product supply in terms of where you get your cheese.
Yeah, I get our Heber Valley cheese, which is as the crow flies from our restaurant, like 3 minutes. So the cheese in our mac and cheese, the cheese on our burger, you know, all of our cheese needs come from Heber Valley cheese, which is the local product. So anything we can get as local as we can, we do. So, you know, like even the slaughter and butcher, that's the closest I could get in the area. The cheese, we get jam from Pepper Lane Farms that goes on our salmon dish. You know, or we used to have a local baker, but now we use Stone Ground, which is down in Salt Lake. But everything I do, even the supplemental meat that we can't sustain from the cows, like one of our steaks, I'll sell 20 a day, but I can't buy 200 cows a month to sustain that, comes from Logan. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've been to the factory, we see what they do. You know, we get to know our producers of the product that we're getting, so... And we try to keep it in Utah. Of course, I can't do salmon and shrimp in Utah, but so what we can do, we do.
Yeah, so a lot of people like to use the term farm to table. You are actually farm out the window, right to your table.
As much as you can, you know, and that's, I think it's become an overplayed term, but yes, you know, and in the summertime, I have local farmers who we use their produce, their tomatoes, their squash. You know, I have deals with those guys. They bring us totes of fresh produce when in season, and we use it when we can. Mm-hmm. You know, there's also a hitting my price point, so it's hard to do that sustainably organic model all the time. It has to work. Our price point for me has to work. I would love to sell sockeye salmon, but I can't because my plate would be $80.
So yes, you know, share a little bit about your price point, because one of the things about Back 40 that I've heard other people say, and it's been my own observation, is it is a value play for a diner.
Yeah. Well, you know, I nothing against Park City, but they've been my biggest advocate. And for that part, it's expensive, right? Their rent structures are expensive. So they have to charge a certain amount to actually make their bottom line, and their seasonality makes it even harder. With what we do, and I don't want to sound cocky about this, but my margins are very low. Right. Mm-hmm. But my volume is very high, and we have a very fresh product. So if I'm doing 500, 600, 700 people a day, which is what we do quite often, but my margins are really low, it's a hard model to beat.
Yeah.
Right. So we can do a good portion. That steak would be twice as much on Main Street, and not that the quality is that much different. It just allows, you know, I own the building. I'm paying like a third of the square footage price what I would be if I was leasing it.
Yeah, so we have a lot.
It allows me to pass that savings on.
Yeah, we have a lot of visitors in town right now. So for our listeners, do you take reservations?
We take reservations for large parties. And when I say that, it's 8 or more. Mm-hmm. You know, when people call in, they'll say, we want a reservation. I say it's for a large party of 8. And then they say, okay, we have 8, and then 6 show up.
Yeah.
You know, that's a kind of the conundrum we get in, but we try not to on, we used to on certain days, like Mother's Day, we'll take reservations. Thanksgiving, we'll take reservations. Those days are just a couple of special days, but you know, having a reservationist is also a full-time job. And I mean, again, we're full quite often, so it's, we don't need to. It's a pain in the butt. I've worked in restaurants where you do, and it can just be difficult to do.
Can you tell the audience a bit about your family carryout meals? Is that something you started during COVID?
It was something I always wanted to do, but we were busy. You know, we were just, our growth has been insane. And as everybody knows, COVID happened right on St. Patty's Day. So I had 100 pounds of corned beef that we had to all eat for a while. we shut down. We shut down for the month, the remaining part of March, and then we just kind of reinvented ourselves, right? So we wanted to do items that you could have in a pan, reheat easily. You know, we just didn't take our menu and do carry out. We limited it to 5 or 6 family meal, you know, 2-4s, and we reduced the staff. I had 3 people in the kitchen and 4 people in the front, and we all worked every day. Everybody else is getting unemployment. And then fortunately, my health inspector at the time went to church with the governor, and I knew that we were going to open May 1 for in-house dining when it was only announced April 29th. So with that information, we were ready to go May 1, where nobody else really knew it was going to happen. I mean, you can't be told April 29th you can open full house and then get your complete staff together, prep, and ready to go. So actually, for the month of May, I think we might have been the only restaurant open in the state of Utah just because of that information. And actually, I finished COVID 20% up.
We have to go, Gary. Real quick, what is the website where people can see things like the carryout menu?
www.back40utah.com.
All right. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Gary.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.